Grant. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be talking about two really fun events that are coming up this weekend. A little later in the hour, you're going to be hearing about a wonderful theatrical reunion that is going to be occurring at Carthage as the cast for a 2010 production of the madcap comedy Room Service reunite for a staged reading in Carthage's Wartburg Auditorium. You're going to be hearing all about that from music theater faculty member and Carthage alum Tommy Novak. That's in part two of today's program. For part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing from a very, very talented tenor who is also a Carthage graduate and happens to be a former voice student of mine by the name of Nicholas Huff. If you were anywhere near the Panoia Park band shell last summer, then you potentially heard Nick Huff singing this spectacular moment from Donizetti's Elixir of the Daughter of the Regiment. That was a concert presented by the solo quartet from the Milwaukee Florentine Opera on the stage of the Panoia Park Bandshell, so in the open air. And this aria, a famous tenor showpiece, A Mes Amis, from the Daughter of the Regiment of Donizetti, calls for the tenor to toss off a total of 9 high Cs. And this is something, that, as you just heard, that Nick Huff does with great ease. And this is just one of the arias that he is going to be singing in a recital this Friday night at the Creative Space in downtown Kenosha. And this is an opportunity in part one of today's morning show for all of you to meet Nick Huff, although at least on one previous occasion you've been on the morning show to talk about some of your operatic exploits at Carthage. But Nick Huff, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And it's fun, of course, to have you coming back to what's sort of your home turf. Just explain to our listeners a little bit about your ties to this community.
Sure. So I went to Carthage, obviously.
But even before that.
My family's from around here. We've lived around here for some time, just either over the border right there in Illinois or here in Kenosha. And most of my family lives here now, went to Carthage. But even before that, I was taking voice lessons with you in high school and coming up to Carthage to do that. And actually singing in the choirs at Carthage in high school. Dmitry Shapovalov, one of the professors at Carthage, is another good family friend. And he taught me piano, so I sat in on his keyboard skills classes. And we've got deep ties. My older sister went to Carthage. Her husband went to Carthage. Actually, my brother just graduated from Carthage. So there's a big Kenosha-Carthage connection for us.
Fantastic. So when was it that you first started to get serious about singing? And when was it evident to you that this was something you really loved to do and had some talent for?
Sure. It's kind of a funny story because when I was a kid, I didn't want to, admit that I liked singing or liked something artsy. I maybe thought that was for girls. I was just a dumb kid, and it took a long time for me to warm up to that, particularly because my mom wanted me to sing, so I wanted to be defiant. Young kids are like that. It was actually not until I was already at Carthage in college that I finally committed to singing, at least. I knew I liked it, and I had sort of admitted that to myself, but we were doing, my freshman year, The Marriage of Figaro, and I was singing Basilio, Don Basilio.
A relatively small part, but a fun part.
And I got to sing him right out of the chute as a freshman, which, that never happens at places that aren't like Carthage. And I just loved it. I loved everything about it. And I thought, I need to do more of this. And that summer, actually, I didn't do much singing. I had a summer job doing, just hard work. And I came back to school and I thought, if I have to do another summer without music, I'm just gonna die. So then I thought, okay, I'm gonna audition for the operas going forward, and I think maybe I'm gonna give this a try.
Well, the rest seems to be history, and you've gone on to do some really, really fun things, and including not only what you did in your 4 years at Carthage, well, and 4+ years since, as you said, you did some singing there even before becoming officially a student there. But then, of course, going on to doing graduate school work at one of the really premier music schools in the country, Eastman. We should just talk for a moment about what it's like when a serious student graduates and has to sort of figure out where the next place should be if you're intending to continue your education as you were. What kinds of things did you weigh in deciding where you should go, what the right place was for you?
To me, the biggest thing is the teacher. So I had a really good teacher that I liked here at Carthage. I went here. When it came to Eastman, I was really interested in Robert Swenson, who's another great teacher for tenors in particular, but all kinds of voices. And he did very well with me while I was there. But, you also look at where is it? How many auditions can I literally afford to do? And how many flights around the country, and how many times in New York City is so expensive. I have a lot of friends that either went to school there or live there now, and you have to think, most kids think room and board, books, but for conservatory, a lot of times if they're in a major city like that, you're thinking about, gosh, an apartment that's $2,800 a month or something, who knows. So it's a lot of money and then a lot of logistics, but the biggest thing is who's going to make me the best singer that I can be, and what kind of shows are they doing? What sort of roles might I get if I go there? And it's a lot. There's a ton of little things that you have to figure out. But eventually, just like when you are picking a college for your undergrad, it's kind of which place feels right and which place feels like maybe I could belong here, and I could see myself spending 2 years working here. So.
So that was Eastman. And, of course, the other thing that I have to ask is Eastman is this famous music school, And one sort of thinks of it in the same breath as one thinks of a place like Juilliard. I mean, in some respects, at least, it's somewhat comparable. And then one thinks about it maybe being a place with a really high bar of excellence and maybe a really competitive atmosphere. I mean, certainly more so than you, for instance, experienced at Carthage, which you know, prides itself on being a kind of a different sort of community than that. And it, for a lot of different reasons, it was not a competitive atmosphere the way a place like Juilliard or Eastman might be. What did you find there in terms of you and your fellow singers? What kind of a group were you collectively?
You know, I was actually kind of worried about that when I went because I, you know, had not really I had waited until I was actually in college to really dig into art music and classical singing, and I didn't feel like I knew. Actually, I remember, I have a great memory. You made me a CD of all the big pieces you thought maybe I should know and notable singers doing them so that I would be able to talk shop with the other kids at yeah, right. at grad school. It's a really – and Mes Amis was on there, actually. I remember texting you and saying, what is this? So I felt like I had catching up to do, and I felt like you know, maybe I was about to go in over my head. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But, you know, I was really lucky. Sometimes conservatory really is competitive and can be nasty. And there are some stories, some wonderful stories about Juilliard, but also some, you know, real horror stories that people have told. And I didn't get any of that at Eastman. You know, you run into the odd ego or, you know, diva, but nobody was outright mean or competitive with me in any kind of aggressive way. I'm still friends with a lot of the other tenors that are there. And we are. It was pretty supportive. In studio class, you know, in music school, you have your lessons with your teacher, and then you have a studio class once a week, which you of course know, Greg, but for your listeners, where everybody sings for each other, all the teachers, students, and that would really be the place that you could see people getting nasty. But it was always extremely supportive. People would say, you know, make some critique or other about your German or your high note or whatever, but it was always the most friendly sort of thing. Right. So actually, I kind of lucked out between Carthage and then Eastman ending up being so nice.
Right. So in other words, a scenario like that could potentially it would have the potential to be a place where you could really undermine the confidence of someone else or think of the sort of snarkiest criticism to offer. And fortunately, as you said, you were fortunate to be amongst some really nice people and good people, and together you did some great, great things.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that I think has turned out to be something of a hallmark of the work that you did during your time at Eastman and since is that you have been involved in really new works. And there's a lovely excerpt from something you sang during your time at Eastman that we'll play a couple moments from, but an opera called Mrs. President that I had never, ever heard of. But it's an intriguing story. Ahead of you talking specifically about this, I just want you to say a word about what kind of a challenge it has posed for you to be confronting really modern scores and learning this kind of music with this kind of difficulty.
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing you should know about new music, if you didn't know anything at all, is that generally speaking, new music is much harder than old music. That's not to say that older music, stuff that's in the standard canon, is like easy. It's really not. And usually vocally, it's very challenging. But new music has kind of a special way of, you know, a special axe to grind against singers, I guess. It's just kidding. But
in many cases, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
In many cases, it feels like it's composed by someone who doesn't necessarily understand how the human voice works or how hard it is to do certain things.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, you can, particularly, you know, people who are working with the, say, composition students in conservatory or something will end up looking at this sheet of music and going, I don't even know how we're going to do it. But, you know, one thing to know is that you sort of have to look at the scores carefully. And, you know, you can't just say, well, this is Donizetti, so it will be quality. You have to read it and go, okay, what's it look like? What are the melodies? How high does it go? How low does it go? And you have to work your way through it and discover for yourself if this is your type of music and if you're going to be able to sing it. And the shows that I've done in new music, have been really wonderful, actually. Mrs. President is a very tonal, romantic, but still, it still does lots of cool new things, but a very, you know, digestible, relatable score about a really cool historical subject. And so you get to do, there's two tenor roles in the show, and one of them is very sweeping and inspiring, and the other is this kind of crazy guy. That's the one I played. And so you get to play this really other dark sort of quality. And that's a cool thing about new music, you know, because I don't know about any of you listening, but I didn't speak Italian or French or German until I started studying opera, which you need to learn to be able to sing those languages. But if I were to just plop down in an audience, I would be reliant on those super titles, on the English text translation. But with new music, a lot of times it's in English. And so you know exactly what we're saying right away. And you can kind of get the emotional impact. There's no delay. There's no lag. And that's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to sing in your own language. And I love music theater. Don't get me wrong. But for it to be opera. So that's a really cool element of doing that. Every time you do, it's a little treat that you get to think about, how am I going to deliver this text? It's like being in acting class again.
Right. Very good. So just say a quick word about this opera called Mrs. President and that intriguing title.
So Mrs. President is an opera by the composer Victoria Bond, who's based out of New York City. Wonderful lady. And she conducted our performance of this. It's about a historical figure, Victoria Woodhull, who was the first woman to run for president in the United States. So it's about Civil War era, circa. And she was ahead of her time in a lot of ways, not just politically, but she started her own newspaper. And she was pretty sexually free, and that's one way that she was not of the times. And this is Joseph Treat, one of her ex-lovers, who really does not get it. He doesn't get that it's quite over.
Okay. So here's a brief moment from this opera called Mrs. President by Victoria Bond, and based on a historical figure from the 19th century. Beautiful voice of Nicholas Huff in a brief excerpt from this opera by Victoria Bond called Mrs. President. You actually have had the pleasure of singing in a couple of world premieres, not Mrs. President. That opera had already existed, but a very, very new opera. But you sang in a world premiere down in Mexico and more recently in San Francisco. Sang the world premiere of a brand new opera by American composer Jake Heggie, who may be familiar to some listeners because I interviewed her ahead of the Milwaukee Florentine doing a Jake Heggie opera a couple of years ago. Just say a word about the experience of being in a world premiere where, I mean, literally nobody else has performed this work before, and what kind of pleasures and challenges that presents.
Oh man, a world premiere is it's a different sort of animal because there's a lot of expectations on it. You're going to be the first person anybody's heard doing this, and you know, there's some pressure associated with that, but it's all good pressure. It's all exciting and stimulating. You know, it's really fun to work on a world premiere. In some ways, as much as I, it's funny that I'm singing a lot of new music professionally because I don't really think of myself as a new music guy. You know, if I could make my career singing Mozart and Donizetti and Bellini, I would do that. That would be a good deal because I love that music.
Yeah, and for fun, you don't tend to listen to modern music, I don't think. Not very much.
Yeah, not especially. I mean, there are some out there. And, you know, the more, it's funny, the more you do, the more you're exposed to it, the more you learn to enjoy. And certain composers like Victoria Bond or Jake Heggie are really relatable. I mean, there are moments in those scores that sound like Puccini. So depending on which composer you're getting, you may actually find that you really like it just as well as stuff in the standard repertoire. But in a way, it's a little more freeing than doing classical rep because nobody's done it before. There aren't expectations. You know, if you sing Nemorino from The Elixir of Love, that aria, Una Furtiva Lagrima, is just a minefield of expectations. And if you decide to try a new ornament that nobody's ever done before or, you know, do this part quiet or that part loud, people will be listening in it and they'll kind of expect the standard thing. And maybe you can slip in something new, but generally speaking, you are beholden to tradition. And that's not true with new music. You know, there's maybe negotiation happening with the composer or with the conductor, but it's a lot more just free expression of what do I think this character is trying to say and how is the best way to interpret these notes and words to put on the best performance that I can. And so in that sense, it's actually, it's a different kind of fun. It's a lot of fun because you get to make something.
Right. In the case of this most recent world premiere, If I Were You by Jake Heggie, this was a production that occurred in San Francisco as part of one of the most prestigious young singer programs in the country. And you ultimately got to sing this performance on the stage of one of the most historic opera houses in the whole country. Tell our listeners just a little bit about all that made this a really special experience for you.
Oh, my gosh. It's difficult to pick just a few things to talk about in a bite-sized, you know, radio-friendly moment because it was so power-packed with fun and with like artistically gratifying moments. It's a pretty lyric role, and I call myself a lyric tenor, but I sing a lot of slightly lighter, higher things. And this role, it did have a few high notes, but it actually sat a little bit lower, and the singing was big. You know, the big high note at the end of the show, the orchestra is sawing away right with you. And so you have to be able to carry right over top of that in a big, noble sound. So I had to, you know, it's a training program besides being just putting on operas, of course, Marilla Opera. And so I had to develop myself this summer in order to really do it well, which was very exciting. You know, it was really cool to see myself working with wonderful people and working every day, all day, to cover the amount of ground that you can cover. Doing that is really cool. You know, you can see yourself improving and you can see the role improving and you get excited to show that to an audience. I mean, Jake Heggie was one of the nicest guys out there. He's kind of a big deal.
He's a very big deal in modern opera and vocal music. One of the biggest names probably in the country.
Yes. And so you land the role and you're so excited and then the reality kind of hits you like, oh my God, I'm going to meet Jake Heggie. Like, it's a little terrifying, but he couldn't have been nicer or more warm or collaborative. You know, just because we were young professionals, he didn't treat us any differently. He was very clear, you know, hey, if you need something changed, if a note's not right for you or a phrase, talk to me about it and we'll get it figured out. And, you know, that's another benefit of working with a living composer. Things can change if they need to, if you want to, depending on your relationship with the composer, you might be able to get something adjusted, which that would never happen with classical rep because it's so set in stone for hundreds of years.
Well, and Mozart's not around to, you can change Mozart, but you're changing Mozart. Mozart's not changing Mozart, but
right.
Jake Heggie can really change Jake Heggie. It's one of the things he gets to do.
Yes. I didn't ask for anything, by the way.
You managed it. And basically this opera had already been composed. I mean, once in a while when we're talking about a world premiere, I suppose a role is crafted with a particular singer in mind. He wrote this and then hoped that there would be a tenor who was equal to its challenges.
Yeah, that's true. The program commissioned it, and then they had done some workshopping, you know, most composers will do that if they can, if the resource is available. Try to have it at least sung through a couple times and hear what it sounds like with piano so they go back and make edits. He had already done some edits, so I think we got the like Mark II version of the score. But, you know, it's never really done. We were in the theater when they asked the one of the last lines, the character is Fabian Hart. One of Fabian's last lines, he's about to, you know, he's just come back from hell, basically, and he's exhausted. And he's talking to his love interest, Diana, and she says, well, everything's okay now. And he says, there's no going back, as if to say, you know, I made a deal with the devil and there's a price to pay. Hmm. But they were worried that that had been said too many times in the show. So they actually changed the line. We were already in the theater and everything. But, you know, for all the benefits of doing new music, you've got to sort of be able to roll with the punches too. Because if if Jake Heggie walks up to you and says, hey, we want to change this line, here's the new line,
yeah,
give it a try, you try it. So.
Absolutely. Well, that's exciting. Just thrilling. And I'm so glad that both your mom and your dad were able to go out to San Francisco and see you on that great stage. We haven't really mentioned, I mentioned it very much in passing, but that little excerpt we heard of you singing at Pennoyer Park was when you were part of a quartet of soloists for the Milwaukee Florentine, the studio singers, I think, or studio artists. So that was a year-long tenure. And now you have coming up a year-long tenure with Florida Grand Opera.
Yes.
And that's going to be exciting to go off to a very different part of the country, but to have also an experience in which you're rooted in one place with one company.
Yes. You know, a young singer tries, if they can, to get studio artist work. And the reason for that is studio artist work usually takes place over a little longer time, because once you're all the way in the deep end of the pool, what you're ideally doing is going contract to contract as a freelance.
Sing this role here, and then a few months later, sing this role here, and so on, and piecing together what you hope will be a relatively full calendar.
Yes. And that's great, and that is actually the goal. But when you're young and just trying to get in, there's no chance of having enough work to piece it together. So what you hope for is a studio artist program, which can employ you for most of the year and give you roles and experience, because it's that classic catch-22. You need experience to get experience, and these are a way in, at least for opera singers. Sorry to the rest of my millennial friends who don't have studio artist programs. But so I've done the one, and that was great and really helpful in getting into things like Marilla and Florida Grand. And now I'm going to go down and spend the year in Miami, which is going to be great. I feel like a snowbird. Like I had a really mild, beautiful summer in San Francisco, and now when everybody in Wisconsin's getting hit with the lake effect snow and everything, I'll be down in the South where it's nice and warm.
Well, when you come up for the Sing-Along Messiah in December, which I appreciate you doing, we'll hope there are a few snowflakes in the air. Not too many, but just enough to remind you of your Wisconsin roots.
Perfect.
So, of course, why we're having this conversation today is because this Friday night, so the day after tomorrow, you are going to be presenting a recital in downtown Kenosha at the Creative Space. And you've put together a lovely program, and you have a really wonderful singer collaborating with you on that program. Tell our listeners what you have put together for Friday night's recital.
Sure. So it's largely an aria recital. So we're going to do a lot of opera arias from hopefully some opera arias that even if you passingly like opera, you may know. We'll do that particular aria I mentioned from Elixir of Love, Una Furtiva Lagrima. A Mes Amis is there on the concert.
The one with the nine high Cs.
The one with the nine high Cs. I do it with 11, but.
Okay, all right.
What else? Oh, we've got some Mozart. You know, next year I'll be singing at Florida Grand Opera the role of Don Ottavio in the opera Don Giovanni by Mozart, which is one of his most famous. And so I'm going to sing both of Don Ottavio's arias there. And actually, in the actual performance, I'm only singing the one, Il Mio Tesoro. So we get to hear both arias, not tomorrow, but the next day. We'll do some music theater, so there will be some things in English where you don't have to follow along with the super titles. Some Lerner and Lowe, a set of Lerner and Lowe, and a little Bernstein, Maria from West Side Story. And then I'll be joined by Keely Futerer, who is a wonderful soprano from Dover, Arkansas, Russellville area. And she and I met at Eastman. And she was singing, she was actually singing The Countess in Marriage of Figaro when I was singing Don Basilio again. So it was kind of full circle. And she will be sort of featured and adding something to almost every set. She'll do several arias. Her aria from La Fille du Regiment, or The Daughter of the Regiment, the same one as A Mes Amis, which she actually just performed the role. She just finished that role at Opera Saratoga in upstate New York. It's a prominent summer opera festival. And it is a beast. In some ways, it's not really fair to the soprano because the tenor gets all the attention for those nine high Cs, but she sings so much hard music and a number of E flats and, you know, really stratospheric stuff. So you'll get to hear one of her, a really fun aria called Chacun le sait from that show, among some others.
Right. Yeah, I, of course, rehearsed with you last night, and I think you've put together a really, really cool program that I think people are going to very, very much enjoy. So we want to remind everybody about the Creative Space right in downtown Kenosha. And can tickets be purchased at the door? I forget how that works.
Yes, tickets can be purchased at the door. So if you just show up, you'll be able to get a ticket, I hope, I think. It's not a very large space, so there aren't a million tickets, but I think that we still have a group of them. So you can get them if you come to the door. You can also go online. There's a Facebook event hosted by the Creative Space and by me on my professional page on Facebook. And there's a link. You can actually get tickets online there. If you just go to either of our pages on Facebook and look under the events, you'll see it. And there's a link to tickets there. So if you want to pre-buy, you can do it that way.
Very good. And the Kenosha Creative Space is at 624 57th Street, right in downtown Kenosha. And their phone number, by the way, is 262-945-9411. And I hope a lot of people will make a point of coming out for what is going to be a delightful and impressive night of opera. And tenor Nick Huff, thank you for being part of the morning show today. Thanks for getting up bright and early on this Wednesday to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here. It's always fun.
It's 8:42 here on WGTD, and here is part two of today's morning show. And for this portion of the morning show, I'm really happy to be sitting opposite a Carthage colleague, faculty colleague of mine, Tommy Novak, a student at Carthage not all that long ago, now a very busy professional actor in the region, and also back at Carthage as an adjunct music theater faculty member, and now pursuing his master's degree at Carthage with our new master's degree in musical theater voice and pedagogy. And the reason we're sitting down with Tommy Novak today is to talk about a really fun project and performance that's going to be coming up at Carthage this Saturday evening. It is a reunion of sorts, a reunion of the cast of a production from way back in 2010. They are reuniting to come together for what I think is going to be a staged reading of a piece called Room Service. And so Tommy Novak is going to, who is part of this, is going to tell us a little bit about this crazy idea that is about to come to fruition. Tommy Novak, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hello, how are you, Greg?
Good to have you. Actually, we've talked at least once on the program, and it's good to be talking to you again.
I'm happy to be back.
So this is such an intriguing idea, and I don't remember ever seeing anything quite like this before. So we are talking about something that happened here at Carthage back in 2010, and I'm assuming you were part of this production back in 2010. So take us first back into ancient history with what happened in 2010.
So my junior year of college, we had an audition at the end of my sophomore year for a play called Room Service, which was a farce that takes place in a hotel room. The play was turned into a film then made famous by the Marx Brothers, but the play is different, and the Marx Brothers put their lens on it. And I auditioned. I almost didn't audition for it. I was so busy. I had 10 minutes to go and audition and almost missed this opportunity that has changed my life. And it was upperclassmen only, and we all auditioned, and there was about 20 people who got cast in the show. It's a big cast. It was written in the 30s, set in the 30s, written in the 40s. the people in that show, we all were at a point in our theatrical education that we were all able to support and be there for each other while exploring comedy, exploring what it means to be an actor, to step into a role with the research and everything. And we were taking great leaps as actors and individuals working on this one show. But the reason we were able to leap is that every single person was always there to catch us. Mm. And that, to me, was so important and has affected me as an artist since this moment. And we all joked, because it's a farce, while we were doing it, that we'll do a reunion. We'll do a reunion down the road, and we'll just get back maybe like 10 years out and read it. And so I thought last year, wow, that's coming up really fast. And I reached out to everyone. Just these people who were in part of the show are very close with me, and I keep in contact and try and see them whenever I can, time permitting and schedule permitting, and they're literally all over the country. But there are people that when I don't see them for a long time, we pick up right where we left off. And we always talk about room service, and we've always had this great feeling. And I reached out if it was still something we all joked about, if we wanted to do it. And everyone said yes. It was like, if this happens, I will be there. I don't know when, but I'm going to make time to make this because it's important to them.
So each person said that, not just you said that.
Not just me. Like, as I started reaching out, I reached out through Facebook, I reached out through emails, through phone calls, and I just posed the idea of, was this something that you would want to come back and do? And every single person, for whatever reason, said, if it's happening, I'm there.
Wow. So you're saying that back in 2010, when all of you originally did this, there was talk of it even then, of getting together in 10 years. And you don't think that was entirely in joking fashion? There was some seriousness about how fun that would be?
Yeah, well, in comedy, like, there's a sense of truth to make it believable. And so we joked about it, being like, yeah, 10 years down the line, because we're in college, we don't know where we're going to be in 10 years, you know, that we were all like juniors and seniors in college, that we didn't know what the next 10 years would hold. But we knew that this moment was important to us, and it rang true as time traveled by, that there were moments we all talked about. There were moments that when we would see each other, we would laugh about the crazy things that happen on stage in performance, or moments in rehearsal. And there's a quote sheet that we kept of like funny things people said that I keep in my professional actor makeup case. Wow. And every time I do a show, I pull out my makeup for what I need. And I read this list and it brings me right back.
Wow. Fun excerpts from this show.
Just things, not from the show, but like things that people said in passing in rehearsal.
Gotcha.
So excerpts from people that were just involved that like made the experience more enjoyable.
Wow. We should probably explain a little to our listeners about where this play is set and who these characters are. And of course, that probably has at least a little bit to do with why this was such an important and meaningful experience for all of you as actors. Explain at least the basic plot behind Room Service.
So Room Service takes place in a hotel, the White Way Hotel in New York City, somewhere in Manhattan, and it consists of a theater director, a producer, and a technician who are trying to put up a brand new play called Godspeed that's written by someone from the Midwest. And they are rehearsing, and they are living, and they are putting the show up in the theater that is in the hotel, but they don't have any money. They're looking for a backer, but they're running up a bill and living and eating and doing what theater people need to do to put up a show. And they're trying to find money, but they're spending money that they don't have. Mm. And the regional manager comes to the hotel and notices that this is happening because the hotel might close because of how negative in the red they are. And I played the hotel manager, the regional manager, and he is trying to get them out because they're not paying. And through a series of door slams and in and outs, and they end up finding a way to make the show happen as well as pay for the production.
Wow. You described it as a farcical comedy, I think might be the way you put it. So is this literally a farce from what you were just saying now? It sounds like at least it has a lot of elements of the classic farce.
Yeah, the whole play takes place, while it's about theater people putting up a show, you never see the production, you hear about it. Mm. And it all takes place in a hotel room. And so like in the hotel room, there's the main entrance, this conjoining room entrance to the room that they share, the second room. a bathroom and a closet. So like a typical farce, there's many doors, ins and out, lots of places to hide, lots of misdirection, lots of misidentification, confusion on who people are because the theater people are trying to not get caught. So, and they're also trying not to get kicked out because they know that the show is going to be something that means a great deal to the greater community, which is probably why this show means a lot to me and why I wanted to bring it back too, because the greater community of Carthage has affected my career as an artist and has helped my career in ways that I couldn't have imagined, even still discovering.
And I guess it's also a matter of a show can be a lot more important than just the show itself. It's the meaning that it has beyond it.
Yeah, totally. The meaning that has beyond it. And we joke that we would just sit around and read it out loud in a living room, someone's living room. That's all that really. So in the great essence of the of this production or this event, it's extremely selfish. We're just reading it once with everyone who did it back then. But I thought, how can we make this have a greater impact and share the feeling that we have with people who didn't live this experience, which is like the essence of theater. And I was like, I got in contact with the offices and wanted to make it an event for Carthage, an event for the community, and anyone that can and is willing to listen to us be selfish for 2 hours is more than welcome to be in the room, because I feel that the people who are involved, I consider some of my greatest friends and colleagues, and have a sense of care and heart that I think just needs to be heard, and the only way is to experience it in person.
One of the things that is intriguing, of course, is that this is a staged reading versus a remounting of the original production, correct?
Yeah.
And, of course, that would be really tricky with people coming from all over the country for a relatively short amount of time. Farces are very intricately staged, typically, so putting something like that together in a rehearsal would be pretty much impossible. Have you thought very much about what this is going to feel like in this very different format? In other words, a farce without the slamming doors and all of that?
So I thought about what can we do to recreate it without the time. And I was like, you know, I think the words are just going to be enough. While people might stand up and sit down in terms of like, and how fast they do that is depending on what, how they enter or exit. Right. But when I reread the play a couple weeks ago to figure out how this thing should function, is that the stage direct, the way that it was written, it's extremely, it calls on the imagination in a way that is so clear from the stage directions and what the people say, that you don't really need much more than that, and you can sort of experience it. And I kind of robbed myself of the experience of hearing it again for the second time with everyone, but just reading it on the page, it flooded back to me like a moving picture. So I'm hoping that will translate with the stage directions read, as well as the that are indicated by the playwright, as well as the lines that people say, because it's funny. There are some funny phrases. There's a lot of physical humor in it that can just be imagined. But I feel like the words are strong enough, and if they're not, the event is free.
Yeah, right. But no, I can see how that might actually work really, really well. And were you able to literally gather everybody back, or are there one or two where it was simply impossible?
Well, there were two people that I tried to contact out of the 20 that were involved that I couldn't make it because of life situations of work and working and is somewhere else. And the other person, I tried as much as I could, very, very different media sources and very different ways of getting in contact with somebody that we can, that's so easy to find somebody. I never heard a response. I've keep sending things out into the void, hoping that maybe it happens.
Interesting. But otherwise, it sounds like amazing that you were able to gather, what, 18 out of 20 roughly those kind of numbers, which is extraordinary.
So we're going to have two, the stage manager, the assistant stage manager, the assistant director, and then the entire cast.
Wow.
And it was a cast of, like, it was a cast of 15.
Will you actually rehearse before the stage reading, or will this likely be just, in a sense, a cold stage reading?
It's going to be rehearsed just because we're going to read it out loud together, just so we know what people need to read and how it's going to sort of function. And they're all theater So most of the people either still do theater professionally or incorporate theater in their lives, and it's a way to get back to something that they love. So just to sort of like let the dust clear, we're going to do a rehearsal where we just figure out how it works and how it functions, from getting up out of a chair, getting to a music stand, and then how that happens. And there is one moment that is purely physical business, and I don't want to ruin it, but there's a physical business thing that is one of the funniest things that people I know who have seen the play, when they talk about room service, they mention this moment from an audience perspective as we talk about it in the cast. And we're going to, I have put in the works of recreating one physical moment that is purely no words, just staging and physical business that will happen. So come for the surprise.
Wow, sounds great. A last question. One of the things that intrigued me, Tommy, is when you said something about the experience of this original production back in 2010, and something you said made reference to the trust that you experienced as a cast for each other. And I think probably our listeners might be surprised to hear that in the doing of a comedy, trust is important, or comedy can foster trust between performers. I know you've done a lot of comedy and you're very, very good at it. So maybe you can explain the connection between comedy and trust.
Yeah. So in terms of comedic things, like we as humans find things funny because we are guided down a path, and the idea of subversion is presented to us. So we are led hand by hand one way, and then all of a sudden it is turned on its head, and then we're like, oh, that's different. And that response is laughter. It's a release of, oh, that was different. I wasn't expecting that. Just like crying is a release. The idea of trust is that we don't know what's going to be funny to everyone collectively. We don't know what will make a big laugh or elicit a response. And so the ability to try a million different outcomes, or an infinite amount of outcomes, for one moment for the product of make people respond or laugh is difficult. And some things are just like, we physically can't recreate time and time again. Sometimes when we laugh, we relate to it because we've been there and we're seeing someone else go through it. So it's a response of, I know that, I understand that, or it's a response of, I sympathize, or it's a response of, this is different. But laughter is an interesting thing to me. And I believe in the personally that as an artist, you can't make somebody cry until you make them laugh, because they don't know how to respond. And because it's a very personal thing, it's easier to make someone laugh before you get them to cry. And both of them, and comedy is formulaically is tragedy plus timing. So it's a calculated tragic event, some people say, and when you have tragedy, you have to be able to be vulnerable and be exposed in some way and reveal some sense of truth that can be hard. It's simpler than slipping on a banana peel and falling down,
right?
Because there's tragedy there, but the time it takes to do that, and the effort and the danger, is how I think comedy and trust go hand in hand. And I think I learned how to calculate that with these 20 individuals all at the same time working towards a product. And probably, you know, I've been reflecting on this a lot, like, am the comedic actor that I am today from this playground that we created.
Nicely put. So the play again is Room Service, one of the great comedies of the last few decades. And so this is a staged reading at Carthage in
the Wartburg Auditorium.
7:30 Saturday night, and this event is free. Do people need to reserve tickets?
You can reserve tickets on the Carthage website or the Carthage Fine Arts website, but don't let that be a reason not to show up. You can also get tickets at the door. The only reason we are ticketing the event is to see how many people show up to share the love and experience that this is. And I hope to see you there.
Tommy Novak, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on the morning show, I hope you'll make a special point of listening to my conversation with Lisa Kornetsky, a longtime member of the theater faculty at UW Parkside, now retired, but she recently served as guest director for the production that opened the current season of the Racine Theatre Guild, Neil Simon's brilliant play, Lost in Yonkers. My conversation with Lisa Kornetsky on tomorrow's morning show. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.